WEOL and 100.3 FM, Andy Bulbarch and Rocco Nushi with you. Had a lot of fun in the opening hour of today's show, getting into some of the effects of the coronavirus and how that's affected travel. And we mentioned a few moments ago the OHSAA releasing a statement talking about how they're going to handle this moving forward. For the time being, limited spectators, family and friends, and that's pretty much it. So again, they'll elaborate a little bit more on that. They're scheduled to have a press conference here coming up at about 4:15. But now it's time for us to head to the hotline to bring in our golf guy, Guy Cipriano. He is the editor of Golf Course Industry Magazine. Last week, Guy joined us from the baggage claim area at the airport in Providence, Rhode Island. Now he joins us from the friendly confines of his office. Guy, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Bull. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to chat golf any day of the week, especially on a dreary Tuesday.
Well, you're on Planet Golf, my friend, and we always enjoy you joining us when you're on Planet Golf, as you always tell me. And there was a lot to get excited about this past week and a very challenging final day at the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill. And, you know, it was interesting on Sunday, just kind of watching it all go down. Every highlight that I saw of Tyrell Hatton, who won this thing, he was really kind of grabbing at the side of his hat, and then he was throwing his club down to the ground at one point. I'm like, boy, that's a guy with a lot of real, raw emotion. Now, he won the event, even though he had a pretty tough final round, but he hung on to win this. Just your overall thoughts on his performance this past weekend.
Yeah, I spent last Friday at Wingfoot, which is the site of this year's U.S. Open. They're hosting it on the West course. And then, you know, over the weekend, I'm watching the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill in Orlando, and I'm thinking Sunday, as I watch the end of this, I'm like, man, I'm watching the U.S. Open. I mean, okay, it was down in Florida and different trees and a different backdrop and different time of the year, but 4-under won the golf tournament, and Tyrell Hatton shot 2-over in the final round. I mean, how tough was Bay Hill playing this weekend? Bull, Brooks Koepka, who has won 4 majors, all on very difficult golf courses, shot 81 on Saturday. And yeah, you're right about Tyrell Hatton. He didn't look like a player that was winning a golf tournament, right? He was throwing clubs. He was cussing at ponds that he hit the ball into, but he held on. And you look at it, final round, 2-over, ends the tournament 4-under. Those are U.S. Open winning scores, not what you expect to see during the Florida swing in early March. But Bay Hill was playing. It was windy, and wind is the greatest defense against the best players in the world. There's been a lot of conversation about whether some golf courses are becoming obsolete because players are hitting the ball so far these days for a number of reasons, whether it's improved conditioning of their own bodies or equipment with the clubs and balls and advancements on that end. But it just proves that when you get some wind and a golf course firms up, you can still see some scores that are close to even par. Very few players broke par in this tournament. And it's 2 weeks in a row where the winner at the Honda Classic Sung J.M. was 6-under, and now Tyrell Hatton at the Arnold Palmer Invitational was 4-under. So those are 2 weeks of golf where there weren't a lot of birdies, which is different than your typical regular season PGA Tour event. And in my opinion, I don't know what you think of this, Bull, but I think it's really fun to watch players have to think their way around a golf course in tough, windy, firm conditions like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Sung J.M. with back-to-back pretty darn good weekends. I mean, he had a decent final day, but, of course, he wasn't able to get past Hatton. And, you know, Hatton, I believe he was 4-over. On Sunday, yet he still hung on to win that tournament. Now, to go along with what you just mentioned there about watching these guys really have to think through this, I thought that Hatton was kind of a fun guy to watch because he showed a lot of emotion, certainly showed some frustration as we've detailed, but guys like that back in the Tiger era really seem to go over extraordinarily well. Do you think guys like that still go over well, not only with the golf crowd, but the common crowd as far as that goes?
Yeah, as long as it doesn't cross a certain line. And think about this. With his win, Tyrell Hatton is now top 20 in the world. And what event do we have looming in September? Well, we have a Ryder Cup, right, at Whistling Straits. It's on American soil again. The Europeans won the last one in France. And could you imagine Tyrell Hatton playing in a Ryder Cup with that type of pressure and that type of patriotism, pulling some of those antics in Wisconsin, and how that's going to be handled by the the crowd. I mean, Ryder Cups are always fun, but when you think about throwing a player into the mix later this year, and a volatile mix like that, where there are definitely going to be some rowdy people in Wisconsin, that's a place where they really like to throw down beers, Bull. I mean, heck, one of the biggest breweries in the country is not too far from Whistling Straits down the road in Milwaukee. That could be a lot of fun, and he's going to be in there. I mean, unless he completely bombs here the next few months, he's going to be in the Ryder Cup, and I think his presence there with his demeanor is going to add some spice to it.
Yeah, and look, the Ryder Cup, too, is where you hear a lot more hooting and hollering from the crowd, too, so that could make things really, really interesting, and that'll give us a lot to talk about here in the next 6 months for sure. All right, well, I wanted to broach this subject because I know in the past when we've had you on, you haven't been too crazy about CBS's coverage of the PGA Tour, but a couple of days ago, there were some whispers, and we heard a few more yesterday, a few more this morning about CBS, NBC, and ESPN renewing their television rights to carry the PGA Tour until 2030 with the rights valued at close to $700 million. Now, your thoughts on all this? I know you mentioned that could be a little bit deceiving getting into all of this. So what are your general thoughts on the dollar amount and the networks involved?
Yeah, let me clarify. I guess my problem isn't with CBS. They've been doing this for six decades at a high level, and a lot of broadcast innovations have come from the CBS golf coverage. But my problem was with some of the changes they made to their broadcasting team, most notably getting rid of Peter Costas and Gary McCord. And if you've listened to some of the subsequent interviews with Peter Costas and Gary McCord, they've been on the podcast circuit now, is that the reason that CBS ousted them is because they were getting pressure from the PGA Tour to shake up the broadcast team. Well, CBS had to acquiesce to everything the PGA Tour wanted because of these TV rights. I mean, this has been hovering over the game behind the scenes now for the last year, and this really is a mega deal in every single way imaginable. Think about that, what you just said. It's going to be a 9-year contract combined with CBS, NBC, Golf Channel, and ESPN Plus now will have the digital rights, $700 million a year. That means purses are going to go up to record numbers. They're already at record numbers. This week at TPC Sawgrass, for example, they're playing for a $15 million purse, and the winner's getting $2.7 million. That purse last year, that's up from $12.5 million purse last year and $2.25 million for the winner. So just imagine what the number is going to be like when this new TV deal kicks in. But a lot of the broadcasting decisions that the networks were making over the last year or 2 years was to try to get themselves in position to land these TV rights because the TV networks and cable companies are desperate for content, especially with the ways that people are consuming media and sports media are changing by the day. And there are very few sports leagues, Bull, that offer as much content as the PGA Tour, and there was a lot of pressure on the PGA Tour to get this rights deal locked in around this time before it drags on too much, is because, I don't know how closely you've been following this, but there have been talks about a Premier Golf League starting an international circuit where there are 18 events with the top 50 players in the world. So with the PGA Tour squeezing in this TV deal now, it looks like the Premier Golf League, at least from the way I see it with some of the numbers that have been kicked around with this PGA Tour TV rights deal, it's going to be tougher for the Premier Golf League to form now.
Yeah, and they've gone after some of the big dogs. I did notice that in weeks past. There are some guys that have come out. Was it Dustin Johnson most recently? Who was it over the last couple of weeks that said, yeah, no thanks, I'm going to stick with the PGA Tour?
That was Rory McIlroy. He's really the first one that's kind of spoke out against it or publicly reaffirmed his commitment to the PGA Tour. He's ranked number one in the world right now. He's probably the second most popular player in the world behind Tiger Woods, if you look at all the metrics and how they're embraced when they go to different places. And, yeah, he's the one that said, okay, I'm fine with the PGA Tour. Now if another league does start, they're going to have to throw around even more money than what was talked about with the Premier Golf League a few weeks ago. And this is a huge win for the players, this TV rights deal. It's a huge win for the PGA Tour. It's a huge win for these networks that are desperate for content getting it. I think it'll be a big win for the LPGA, because if you really read the fine details in some of the articles that have come out and the deal, although the LPGA Tour and the PGA Tour are separate entities, the LPGA is going to get more inclusion on the networks and on Golf Channel, which is great for the game. I mean, women's golf is a huge potential growth area for golf. In my opinion, golf doesn't do the Golf Network's do an awful job of showing people the women's game and some of the great things that are going on with that. For whatever reason, it's just not as prominent on the networks or even on Golf Channel. And one of the other fascinating things with this TV rights deal is that the PGA Tour now will be producing the entire broadcast besides the announcers. So when you watch a tournament, it's not going to be the NBC or the CBS feed. It's going to be the PGA Tour feed. They're going to have all the cameras, all the shot link data equipment, all the sound, and that's going to be interesting to see how that's handled. Because, I mean, what happens if a player like Harold Varner at Riviera tops a shot, or Max Homa last week shanked a shot into the bleachers? You know, the PGA Tour controlling the entire broadcast now, besides the announcers, are they even going to show those type of moments? Are they going to show a Tyrrell Hatton swearing at a pond after he dumps a ball into it on the back nine of Sunday of a tournament? So it's going to be really interesting to watch these broadcasts in 2022 and see what's shown and what's not shown, because the PGA Tour, although they have a commissioner and a huge office staff of a couple hundred employees, the players are the members. They own it. It's kind of like a country club, and ultimately the say in the PGA Tour goes down to what the players and what the Players Council wants.
Again, we're speaking with Guy Cipriano. He's the editor at Golf Course Industry Magazine here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. One subject we're going to broach a little bit later on with this TV deal. I know Darren Rovell with the Action Network has talked about this in the past. Golf is really trying to get to the forefront of this, as you know, the sports books and that entire scene just continues to blossom on a national level, not just a state-by-state level. You wonder how much of the real-time betting, shot-by-shot, that could certainly be something that blossoms and becomes a big part of this as well. But again, we'll table that for a little bit later on. You recently came back from a pretty cool trip. You were in the New England area. You mentioned Wingfoot a little bit earlier also. Your thoughts on that entire trip and how cool the U.S. Open is going to be a little bit later on this year?
Oh, it's going to be great. And one of the things that people don't understand about Wingfoot is that there are two golf courses there. The U.S. Open is played on the West Course, but they have an East Course that is every bit as good as the West Course. It's also in the top 100 of all the world rankings. And the U.S. Open's become so big right now is that they have all this infrastructure, you know, corporate tents, hospitality tents, kitchens, media centers. And guess where all that's going, Bull? It's going on the East Course. So imagine being a member at a private club, 36 holes, and having all these structures put on a beloved golf course that is expected to be high-level conditions every time a member plays it. So from my perspective and what I cover, agronomy and construction and architecture, that's almost as fascinating as the tournament. But, yeah, Wingfoot's a cool place. This will be its sixth U.S. Open, I believe. Bobby Jones won a U.S. Open there in 1929. Hale Irwin won the massacre at Wingfoot in the 1970s. You look at the players that have won there. I mean, Phil Mickelson almost won there in 2006 when it last had a U.S. Open. It had a PGA Championship won by Davis Love III when a rainbow came up, which kind of, you know, signified his memories of his deceased father who taught him the game. A lot of stuff that happened at Wingfoot. It's one of the most historic venues in golf, and that's going to be a fascinating place to watch a U.S. Open in June. And it was cool to get there. It was a pretty rough, raw early March day when I was there. I was mainly in the turf care facility conducting some long interviews with the people I deal with, but I did get to go out on the golf course and see it for the first time. And I'll just say the green complexes are heavenly, and the golf course was recently, both golf courses there were recently restored by a architect named Gil Hans, who's doing a lot of high profile projects, and he worked in tandem with the agronomic team at Wingfoot led by Steve Rabideau, and it's pretty fascinating what they've done with the greens, and you'll be hearing a lot of conversation at U.S. Open time about how severe the greens are at Wingfoot.
And it's interesting, too. You mentioned in there the transformation that has to take place with the two different courses that are there, but I think part of the fascination of being involved with a group like that and being part of a group like that is that, look, when everybody sees the U.S. Open on TV, if you're a member of that particular course or that club, you think to yourself, you know what, it would be kind of cool to get out there and play again pretty quickly. But that transformation has to be kind of quick. But when you think about all that goes into not only the television production, but the entire production, just trying to get that course ready to rock and roll for a four-day event, there are so many things that go on behind the scenes, and there's only so much time that crew has to get that course ready to rock and roll for the members to come back in and play again.
Yeah, it's a huge undertaking, and we'll get into this more, Bull, as we get closer to the U.S. Open. But to relate it to your listeners, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have been to Firestone, when it had the WGC Bridgestone Invitational, and before that, the World Series of Golf. And you think about it, Firestone Country Club has three golf courses, right? Well, it's and the WGC Bridgestone was a huge event, you know, one of the biggest events in the world. It's not a major championship, but they were able to keep all the infrastructure on the South Course there, and the West Course and North Course, when Firestone hosts events, are actually open for member play. Wingfoot's got 36 holes, and most of the second course, the East Course, which is an elite course, is going to have infrastructure on it. So that gives you an idea of how big a U.S. Open is compared to a big event such as the WGC Bridgestone Invitational.
Well, speaking of big events, we've got one coming up this weekend, the Players' Championship. You did a story on TPC Sawgrass last year, so that gives you at least a little bit of insight on the course and that how that could affect the field this weekend. So what are your general thoughts on the Players' Championship this weekend?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I got to visit TPC Sawgrass last January, about 6 months or 6 weeks before the Players' Championship. First time I had ever been there. Like anyone else that loves the game of golf or watches golf on TV, you have this image of TPC Sawgrass and what it's like. And when I walked around and toured the property, one thing you realize is just how compact it is. I mean, the golf course is it's a par 72, and it's not even 7,200 yards, which might sound a lot to the average listener, 7,200 yards. But to a PGA Tour player, that's not a very long course for less than 72 yards. Par 72, and the greens are just so small. It's a fascinating place. The PGA Tour headquarters are there. It was really the first course built for spectating purposes. It was built on a swamp, an awful piece of land by Pete Dye and his wife Alice Dye, and it was the vision of former PGA Tour Commissioner Dean Beaman. In the late 70s, they started building the golf course. It opened in 1980, hosted the Players' Championship for the first time in 1982, and it's been there ever since. It moved to May. Now it's back to March. This is the second year where it's been in March again. It's on an overseeded golf course. When it was in May, it was on a golf course with warm season grasses, so that changes how the tournament's played, and it should be a fun week. There'll be a huge crowd there. There always is. It's the PGA Tour's marquee event, because what a lot of people don't understand is that the PGA Tour doesn't put on the four major championships. Those are all separate organizations, with Augusta National, the United States Golf Association, the PGA, and the RNA put on the four majors. So this is the biggest event under the PGA Tour umbrella. The PGA Tour owns TPC Sawgrass. Their headquarters are there. There's another golf course there that's awesome called Dyes Valley, and it's just a big, sprawling place, and it was really built to host this event. And this event always has a lot of juice, and it's losing some juice this year because Tiger Woods isn't playing. His back still isn't ready to go again, which really is probably making a lot of people wonder if he's even going to be ready to go to defend his Masters title right now. That's, I guess, a story for another show. But there's a lot going on at TPC Sawgrass, and if you ask a PGA Tour player what event they want to win besides the four majors, this would probably be number one on everybody's list, especially the players that are motivated by money. Like I said, a $15 million purse, and that's bigger than the purse at any of the major championships.
Do you think the course, the way that it's constructed, gives anybody in particular a little bit of an advantage this weekend?
That's a heck of a question, but if you look at some of the past winners, it's been all over the place. You've had big hitters. You've had straight hitters like a Calvin Pete in the 80s and a Fred Funk in, I think, 2005 he won. And those two guys are some of the shortest hitters on the tour. And then you've had winners come out of nowhere. I mean, does anybody remember Tim Clark, Stephen Ames, or Craig Perks? Those are guys that have won Players' Championships in the last 20 years. And there have been big hitters that won. I mean, Rory McIlroy won last year, and he's the biggest of the big hitters. And Adam Scott's won there recently. And it's kind of all over the place. I mean, Siwoo Kim won there, I believe, 3 years ago, and he was only 20, 21 years old and didn't really have much experience play the course. So it's not like Augusta National, where you have to have a certain amount of length to win. I don't think you're going to see a guy like, well, I mean, Fred Funk now is on the Champions Tour, but I don't think you would have ever seen like a Jim Furyk win at Augusta National, although we did see Zach Johnson win there, so I guess that throws out that theory about length being paramount in the Masters. But I would say that of the big events on the golf circuit, this is the one that might have the most possibilities in terms of a winner. Although I do think there's some clear favorites for this year.
So who are your clear favorites this year, my friend? Because the first time we ever had you on the show, you knocked it out of the park and you predicted the winner. So you've got a lot to live up to here, my friend.
Well, I said last week, right, that Rory McIlroy was either going to win at Bay Hill or at TPC Sawgrass. Well, he was in contention at Bay Hill and really floundered in the final round. So I guess if I was a man of my word, I would say that Rory McIlroy is going to win this week. But the more I think about it, I'm going with a different player. Rory is certainly the favorite. If you had $20 to wager, he's probably the one that has – I know he has the best odds and would be maybe the safest bet. But you look at a person that really could break out here, and I'll give you a name, and he was in contention last year, and he's pretty much in contention wherever he goes these days. John Rahm is right on the cusp of having a breakthrough win like the Players' Championship or WGC event or even a major championship. He's a top 10 machine. His last five starts in 2020, he's been 10th, 2nd, 9th, 17th, tie for 3rd. The people that watched last year's Players' Championship might remember that he was in contention and had a good chance of winning and then made an awful course management decision on the par 5 11th hole and never recovered from that despite the objections of his caddy. He went for the green and dumped it into a hazard and just didn't recover from that. But John Rahm, to me, is right up there with Rory McIlroy as the two favorites this week. And, you talk about Tyrrell Hatton being a hothead and losing his temper. That's been John Rahm over the course of the last few years or ever since he turned pro. He seems to be getting a little bit better with controlling his emotions on the golf course. And if he can do that in those key moments this weekend, this could be his week for his first breakthrough win. He's won all over the world and he's won multiple PGA Tour events, but he hasn't quite won, that next level event, a WGC event or a Players' Championship or a major championship, and he could bag a few of those this year. He's playing that well.
Great stuff. Guy, as always, we appreciate you joining us. Always fun to have you on to talk about some golf, and we're going to hold your feet to the fire next week to see if Rory McIlroy or John Rahm come out on top this weekend. But as always, Guy, we appreciate the time.
No problem. It'll probably be a player that we didn't even think of mentioning, like Andrew Landry or somebody like that. Well, thanks for the time, Bull, and have a good rest of the show.
Thank you, Guy. I appreciate it. You do the same, my friend. That's Guy Sim-